This is Mame Warren. Today is the 14th of May, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia, with Robert Huntley. And we're just talking about Rupert Latour. And I remember him so well. He was a constant presence just outside your door.
Yeah.
And
he was, and my predecessor, Fred Cole. He had the same role for Fred that he did for me. But it wasn't the role for me that was significant. It was he had an enormous institutional memory as well as personal memory of all the students and faculty who had ever been here during his very long years at Washington Lee. And he loved people, and of course was devoted to Washington Lee, so that he was able to make people, both those who were living and working here then, and students here then, and those who had ever been here, feel at home at W&L in a way that almost no one else could do. He greeted freshmen every year for, I'm sure, 25 years when they came in. And he knew virtually every student on the campus, both present and past, and made them feel it was very special for him to be here. So he was invaluable in many ways, but that's the main one that I remember about him.
What did he teach?
Political science. He retired before I became president, a good while before. And then Fred Cole asked him to serve in this special role as a, I suppose, assistant to the president, I believe we called him. And not something you would ask many to do. And he had a second career that is the main one I remember as his second career. I didn't actually have him as a teacher, so I can't comment on that. But his second career was lasted a long time because he lived to a ripe old age, as you know. And he was sort of part of the institution that's very much missed. So he would have been fun to talk to if then he would get to him. I always was hoping someone would do an oral history while Rupert was around to talk.
Well, as far as I know, no one ever
did. No one
and
ever
it's,
did.
It's such a shame.
No one ever did. He founded, he was one of the founders of ODK, which you know was founded here back in the, well, you have to look up the year, but probably 1915 or something like that. And so he's literally part of the institution's history. And I mentioned earlier Bill Pusey, he would have been equally interesting to talk to. I'm sorry you didn't get a chance to talk with him. And of course, Jim Lavin. I miss those people. But you're right in your earlier comments that the most distinctive feature about Washington Lee is its people, now and in the past, I think.
Well, when you think back, who were those really important people to you? And we can go, let's go all the way back to when you were an undergraduate. In fact, where did you come from?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And what drew you to Washington and Lee in the first place?
Well, my brother had been here, but that just pushes the question one step further back, I guess. My parents had been friends of the Gaineses. Dr. Gaines was president of Washington and Lee for a quarter of a century, as you, I'm sure, have read, and was president when I came here. My parents knew Dr. Gaines before he came to Washington Lee as president. He'd been president at Wake Forest College in North Carolina. And my father was alumnus of Wake Forest. My mother was from the town of Wake Forest. And the college was then located in the town of Wake Forest. It's now located in Winston-Salem, as you know, but in those years it was located in Wake Forest. And so they came to know the Gaineses personally while the Gaineses were in Wake Forest and became friends. And I suspect that was the, I knew the Gaineses from my childhood because we took summer vacations together when we were all children, when their children and my brother and I were young. We took vacations together and so we knew them from years, and I'm sure it was that relationship that attracted my brother and then me to come to W&L. Most folks from North Carolina go to North Carolina, as you know. go to one of the Carolina schools. So
had you been on campus before you started
Yes. We'd been up to visit my brother, who is 4 years older than I am. We'd been up to visit him, on some occasions while I was in high school. And I'd been up to visit the Gaines once or twice. So yes, I'd been on campus. It never occurred to me to go anywhere else. Never sought to go anywhere else, to either undergraduate or law school. So it was automatic, it seems.
So you mentioned President Gaines. Tell mm-hmm. me about him.
Well, he was an extraordinary man, as I'm sure others have told you. He had the most winning and winsome personality and manner of anyone I've ever known, and not referring just to his public speaking, for which he was so well known and about which you must have heard, an orator of the kind that we don't have anymore. I mean, that no one has anymore. I don't mean that we at Washington don't have anymore. I mean that don't exist anymore. But apart from his public presence, he was he could enter a room and everyone in the room would feel at home and part of the group instantly, immediately, right that minute. And that's a rare talent that I'm not sure I've ever encountered to the same degree anybody else. He also had a powerful intellect and a great devotion and vision for Washington Lee. So he was a gripping personality. And no one who ever knew him would ever forget him. And so was she, his wife, Sadie Vernon, delightful and beautiful lady who complimented his personality. He was a grand person. I knew him as a child, and then when I came back here as a student, and then he was president when I came here to work. So I knew him in all three capacities, right until the time he died. I saw him the day he died. So they were grand people, and I was devoted to them, and came back here to teach, in large part because of him. In part, certainly. He was dean of the law school. In those days, when I came back to teach, was Clayton Williams, another marvelous character in Washington Lee's history, who had taught me, of course, when I was a law student. And I had no intention whatever of teaching. I thought it really never crossed my mind. I was practicing law in Northern Virginia with a firm, good firm in Northern Virginia, and enjoying it. I'd been there about a year, only about a year, and Dean Williams came up one call and asked me to come by and see me, and came by to see me and asked me if I'd consider coming back to teach. And that was the first time the thought had come into my mind, and it seemed an exciting thing to me. Just instantly knew that's what I wanted to do. And within a matter of a few weeks thereafter, I agreed to come back and did that year, teaching at law school, and then stayed on until the memory of man runneth not to the contrary. But I had no intention of doing anything other than teaching. No intention of becoming an administrator, no expectation, no desire actually to become an administrator. Those things just happened as time went on. But I enjoyed the teaching enormously. That was my, those were very happy years. All my years here were. My teaching years were wonderful. Taught for 10 or so years, and then ended up in administration. Just that circumstance turned out. But that's sort of one of the characteristics, I think, of Washington Lee's past, and I suspect its present, is that most of the people who held the positions, the academic positions and the dean's positions and so on at Washington Lee, were there as an incident of their teaching. Very, very few of them. I'm trying to think if there were any. Were seen primarily as administrators.
I think Leyburn came to
be
the dean.
He did come to be the dean, but he was not seen primarily as an administrator, at least not by the students. And I don't know that he was by his colleagues. Leyburn's greatest strength was his teaching while he was dean. And I'm sure he would have placed his teaching on a higher level of importance in his administration. Certain that he did. Too bad he's not here so you could ask him, but I know that's what his answer would be. And so he did come back. He was brought back by Gaines to be dean of the university, only dean of the university I think we've ever had. Might want to check that, but I think that's right. And but he taught. I had him. He taught me the first year he was here, which I think was 1948. I was a sophomore undergraduate student, and he taught me in his basic course in sociology, which was a wonderful course. And I was gripped by him. Everybody was who ever had him as a teacher. So I remember him mainly as a teacher, and then subsequently as a friend. After I came back to teach, he was still here teaching. He'd gone back to, he was no longer dean. So he remained many years after he was dean. And I don't know how many years he was dean now, but a decade, perhaps. And then went to full-time teaching and brought in strong faculty into his department, and he was responsible for bringing strong faculty to other departments while he was dean. But he was a extraordinary person. But all of those people, Leyburn specifically included in that group, saw themselves as saw their highest mission as their relationships with the students and with other faculty, as from a teaching perspective. And that perhaps that wasn't unique to Washington Lee. I think that was a more common characteristic of colleges in those days than it is now across the country. But I think Washington Lee had and has preserved that that perspective to a greater degree than most have. And certainly that's the, I mean, I can recall having to talk people into taking dean's positions. That was rarely seen as a step up. It was seen as an obligation and a duty, and that would have been the view that Pusey would have had of the job. Bill Watt would have had of the job. You want to talk to Bill?
Yes.
Well, ask him.
I will.
That Atwood would have had of the job. That even the dean of students, Lou John, would have had of the job. And again, he saw himself primarily as a teacher. He's here. You can ask him that. Now, maybe did that mean they were not as expert as managers as they would have been had they been professional managers? I don't know. I don't think so. I think they had to sort of learn the management job as they did it. But they were bright fellows, and I guess didn't find that to be too tough a study. Especially since their objectives were to facilitate the lives of the people around them, as distinguished from elevating their own ambitions. And if those are the objectives of the people who are running the institution, it tends to make management easier, I think. And I believe that's continued to be the attitude of the people who work here now. Best I can see, it has. So that's why when you talk to alumni and others who've been here, I think you will find it true that almost invariably, and you need to talk to, and you will, I'm sure, you have talked to some alumni, but I'll talk to as many as you can. I've talked to thousands over the years. The thing they nearly almost always remember first and speak of most emphatically is their relationships with the other students and the faculty. The communal spirit in the place. That's what they think about first. They had other things, but that's the first thing. For those who liked the place, now of course there were always those who didn't. And in most cases, those who didn't because for some reason the personal relationship didn't work for them. And there were, I'm sure there were such, I know there were such people. But for the majority, the community was a special place, which they had never seen before and have never seen since. Which is what explains the depth of their commitment to the school. It's what makes it possible for us to live in the style to which we've become accustomed.
Having just experienced my first reunion weekend, I know exactly what you mean. It was a remarkable scene.
Well, it is. If you look at the just the most tangible output of that sentiment, it is the financial support of the school, because, as I'm sure you know, the vast bulk of the school's funds has come from individuals, from ordinary human beings who went to school here. The vast majority of it has come from there all over the years, still does. And well, that again is probably not unique, it is extraordinary. Washington Lee is not, for the most part, institutionally financed. It's personally financed. And from a practical point of view, one of the good results of that is that no single person or institution has a claim on the school. The school is not beholden to any organization or institution or person or group of people. And by reason of finance. So it provides an enormous opportunity for independence in the true sense of the institution. One of the curious things about Washington's early history, I think, is that it never formally affiliated with any organization, even with the church, which again, I believe probably is unique. If you go back to the early years of the schools that were in existence in the colonial days and the immediate post-colonial period, state universities for the most part hadn't come along, and essentially all were church-related. Now Washington Lee, of course, was founded by Scotch-Irish Presbyterians in the Valley of Virginia, but was never affiliated with the church or any other organization. So the devotion of the alumni is a fortunate thing for the school. It really is. But that's the thing they mentioned first, the personal relationships, I think.
You know, one thing I'm curious about is the students, because my concentration has been on alumni, I haven't really talked to that many present-day students, but those that I have already seem to have that sense of obligation.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Was that true when you were a student?
I have talked to them too now, and I find that to be true. Yes, it was true.
Mm-hmm. When you were a student,
yeah.
How did you come to that realization?
Well, I really don't know. It sort of seeped in. I don't think anybody ever gave a speech to us telling us that we were obligated. If anybody ever did, I don't remember it. Even Gaines, with his oratorical ability, I don't recall he's ever giving a speech to the students saying, "Now, listen here, young fellas, you're obligated." If he did, I don't remember it. So it was certainly not something we were explicitly taught. Now, I'm sure they're not now. It does, and again, not for all of them, of course, but for a substantial percentage of the students, they leave here feeling that they've inherited something from the past and they owe something to the future, both financially and otherwise. There are downsides to that, the downside being that alumni are very thin-skinned about Washington Lee. They think it belongs to them. They don't think that in a literal sense, but they think they're entitled to a view on what goes on here.
Tell me more about that.
Well, they do, for the reasons we've already mentioned. And so when things occur that they don't like or that they do like, they're outspoken. And of course, they can only be so well informed I mean, no matter how close they are, their level of information is not nearly as good as that of the folks who are here all the time. So sometimes they have reactions to Washington Lee's this or that action that is not well informed and is emotional. Other times, though, they bring a viewpoint to bear on a problem that you would have otherwise overlooked. I mean, there are some advantages to being remote enough from the daily grind to have a special view about it. So the people who run the school, the presidents and others who run the school, need to understand that, and they do understand it. I think have. Gaines, I'd give Gaines a lot of credit for that and for having developed a relationship with alumni that is healthy. They don't run the school, but their attitudes about the school are taken quite seriously. A lot of effort is spent to communicate with them in ways that I think are generally good. But as I say, it has both sides. And alumni do, you could sense that at the reunion weekend. They do think the school is that they have a proprietary as well as an emotional interest in the institution. And I guess that's good. And everybody else here does too. Yeah. Faculty and the present students think that.
And the people who've just come on board, like me, I already care a great deal about this place.
And it's one of the interesting things is that, of course, again, there are exceptions, but rarely, so rarely that I could name them on the fingers of one hand, though I shan't. Can I recall anyone's leaving Washington Lee whom we wanted to remain? Now there are some exceptions, but they're rare. Most folks who come here to work want to stay. And a lot of folks who come here to school want to stay. The size of the town of Lexington doesn't permit.
I remember when I first moved here in 1977 being very impressed at how well educated all the carpenters were.
Philosophy majors at Washington Lee.
Oh, dear. Sometimes you had to remind them to pound the nails.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
They were always thinking about what the nails perspective was for operation.
Oh, dear. You're quite right.
So let's go back to your undergraduate days.
Well, I was an indifferent undergraduate, indifferent student. Not a very good student. I had a marvelous time here. It was probably a little slow to grow up. I came to school here when I was just barely 17. I just turned 17. The student body was, the average age of the student body in 1946 was probably, I'm guessing, probably 22 or 3. Well, you see, World War II was just over, and mm-hmm. returning veterans constituted the majority of the student body. Three-fourths of it, I guess. So it was an unusual time to be a 17-year-old on the Washington Lee campus. But it was a marvelous time. I had wonderful 4 years and lots of friends whom I've still got. And managed to learn something in the process, despite an indifferent approach to academia. Had some great teachers, Laban and Pusey, for example. And who eventually managed to stimulate even an intellect as dull as mine. Bill Jenks was teaching here then, as he had retired recently, a marvelous teacher. Steve Stevenson was a brand new young teacher. He just started in 1946, died a year or so ago, I guess, German teacher. My math professor was Livingston Waddell Smith. Great mathematical mind and wonderful character. The faculty was populated with characters. It probably still is, but we tend to think of characters from our own past. Smith was just a marvelous character.
Why was he a character?
Well, he was a brilliant mathematician, and most of us certainly weren't. And And he tolerated us, but not always willingly. And he would, in class, I recall, he would send you to the board to work out a mathematical problem or whatever, and would allow you to get to a certain point and see you were stuck. And you would say, for example, I can recall him saying, "Mr. Hudley, what's the sign there? Is it a plus? Is it a plus?" "Yes, sir, it's a plus." "Hell no, it's a minus!" And he was, there were many legends about Smith throwing erasers. He would throw erasers out the window. We'd throw erasers, and once he threw one out the window while I was there in his class, he would vent his spleen at the students in that way. What a wonderful teacher. And Werner Royston taught me math also. He's still here, still alive.
And who's that?
Werner Royston. He's right here in town. In the history department, I've already mentioned Dr. Jenks, and Dr. Crenshaw taught me. Dr. Bean, L.L. Bean, was a wonderful teacher. Had a great style about him. "Now you want to watch it. You want to watch this man. He gonna merge," meaning emerge. That meant that in the early days of a history course, he would want to identify the people who would be important for the remainder of the course. You want to watch him. He gonna merge. That's what that meant. Wonderful teacher. I'll tell you somebody you ought to talk to is Roger Mudd. Have you talked to Mudd?
Not yet. We're going to talk in the
fall.
Ask
Mudd about Dr. Bean, for example. There are a lot of stories about Dr. Bean. Dr. Mosier, I mentioned him. Wonderful history professor. I was an English major. And as I say, eventually even a intellect as uninterested as mine was able to be stimulated by some of these teachers. At the moment, any English teachers, the co-heads of the department were Drs. Fenoy and Moffat. Fitzgerald Fenoy, who was Washington Lee's first Rhodes Scholar. You can see his picture over there on the wall in the library of Rhodes Scholars. He was a professor of English, but principally Shakespeare and latter-day drama also, but Shakespeare was his. I always thought Fenoy believed himself to be Falstaff. I don't have any absolute proof of that. He was a grand figure and a marvelous classroom performer, and spoke in stentorian tones. I remember the students using a fancy dress from time to time that asked him to be the caller. To introduce the couple as they would come down the aisle because of his wonderful way of speaking. But he was an exciting teacher, absent-minded to almost the nth degree. I recall on more than one occasion he'd begin to teach the wrong class. He was in the classroom and would begin on subject A when in fact this was the class in subject B. Would begin on Ibsen when it was a class in Shakespeare or something. And would usually catch himself. And
did anyone ever have to remind him?
Once or twice. Although also once or twice no one ever did. He went right through teaching the wrong subject. He was a marvelous character. He was not great on student names. Absent-minded, I say. And he never knew my name, though I was an English major. He knew me, but he didn't know my name. And in fact, I graded papers for Dr. Fenoy. I bet it's true, though I don't have any way of proving this. This is the only instance in the school's history when we had graders. That would be quite contrary, you see, to the Washington Lee philosophy of teaching. And that was done only because of Dr. Fenoy, who was such a prized member of the faculty that he sort of got away with things others might not have got away with. And he would not grade, so the story was. This is the story we as students thought to be true, and I have no reason to think it wasn't true. He would not grade sophomore survey English papers. The survey course that was then taught to sophomores was a required course. And he opposed the teaching of a survey course in anything. He thought that to be impossible to do. And he opposed requiring anything. So for two reasons, he didn't think that course offering was good. But he had to teach it because there weren't enough professors of English for him not to. Every student in the student body was going to take it, so he had to teach it. But he wouldn't grade the papers. So the department hired a senior English major each year to grade the sophomore papers for Dr. Fenoy. And because Dr. Fenoy had them graded for him, then they were graded for the other members of the department in the sophomore English course, too. That was my job one year, my senior year. I was the grader. I graded the sophomore English papers. Presumably he would look them over before he awarded the grade on what he did or not. But I recall I'd be in his office. I used his office as a place, because he rarely used it in the evening, as a place where I would sit quiet to grade papers. And every 2 weeks there was a test given in the English course, survey English course, and I had to grade the test. And there were themes. Every other week there was a theme or something to be written. I'd look at those, read those. He occasionally would come in the office when I was sitting there grading and would look at me, clasp his hand to his forehead like this. Oh, he'd say, "Oh, yes, Mr., don't tell me, Mr. But finally he might get Huntley. When I came back to teach, he welcomed me, but he still couldn't remember my name. But he was a wonderful teacher. So those are among the teachers I remember. And of course, the dean of the dean of students was Frank Gillum, whom you must have heard a lot about.
Not really. I'd love for you to talk about him.
Well, he's one of the great characters in the school's history, I would think. I think that's the reason why you need to talk to more alumni than you've shown me in your list, because the majority of alumni of that period would remember Gillum as one of the most important teachers in their lives. Well, he knew all the students, literally knew all the students. He learned every student's name before they enrolled, by hard study, before he'd ever met them, by reference to their pictures and their names. He just studied their names and pictures so that every student, when he entered Washington, was already known by name by the dean of students. And from then on out, he knew all the students in the student body by name, and called them all by name when he greeted them, and continued to know them by name for the rest of his life and the rest of their lives. So he knew by name literally every alumnus who had been to Washington Lee over a period of 20-some years, every one. And he knew not only knew their names, but he knew about them, what their backgrounds were, what their needs were likely to be, what their weaknesses were, where he could help them. And he was available as a wise resource to any student in the student body at any time. Not all students took advantage of that, but a lot did. And he made people. I was talking to a friend who was staying here with me over the weekend, Merrill Plaisted from Richmond, who was a student here in the just after I was. And his recollection of Gillum, Plaisted came here from Maine, from a small town in Maine, and had never been here before and was a stranger to the area. And of course, no one else in the student body came from his small town in Maine, if indeed from Maine at all. And his recollection of Gillum's ability to make his years here good ones was very touching. So Gillum was a wonderful dean of students. Could be stern when need be, but the main feature of his personality was one of standing by to be helpful. He was still here as dean of students when Leyburn came as dean of the university. And those were Dr. Gaines's latter years, and Dr. Gaines was not as active in his later years as he had been earlier. He'd been president for 20-some years, and by the time Dr. Leyburn came, Dr. Gaines had already been president for 20 years, I guess. And so much of the administration of the university occurred between Frank Gillum and Jim Leyburn. And to a lesser degree, but to a significant degree nevertheless, the then treasurer, whose name was Earl Mattingly, whom you must have heard something about by now.
I've read, but I haven't heard.
Mattingly was the treasurer, and kept a firm grip on the school's limited finances. and they were quite limited. And parceled out the pennies carefully over all those years. So the three of them were sort of a triumvirate in the years between Leyland's arriving and Fred Coles becoming president in 1960.
Were you involved in sports?
I was on the crew, which we no longer have, in my junior and senior years, as was incidentally Roger Mudd. He rode the sixth position, I rode the fourth position on the varsity crew. We rode on the James River, a course which no longer exists because of ZEPCO, the power company, for whatever reason decided to get rid of the dam that made it possible to row on the James in those days. You couldn't row the James anymore. You couldn't use it as a course. That probably explains the fact that the sport is gone. But I had a marvelous time on the crew. We did fairly well. A lot of fun with it. I had a coach named Anderson, whom Mudd called the Mad Swede. I have to ask Mudd about the crew team. We have a marvelous story for you on that.
Great. Okay. I will. So, how did an English major decide to go to law school?
Well, that's not an unusual combination. That's, I think the law school, I mean, certainly when I was a law teacher, and I always felt that, undergraduate majors in humanities were the ones we preferred to get. So that was not an unusual combination in law school, following an English major or history major. How did I decide to go? I don't know. I was out for 4 years between undergraduate and law school.
Did you recall
there was a war going on then, and while it seems to have been forgotten by most folks of your age, the draft in 1950 was every bit as comprehensive as the draft had been in 1941. Everybody. It was unlike the Vietnamese draft, which was selective, I think, and flawed for that reason. The Korean draft was analogous to the World War II draft, and every warm body, every warm male body had to go into something. Again, we seem to have forgotten now, but it was then thought that we were at threat of major world war. Happily, turns out not to have been the case, but all of us had to go into something. And I joined the Navy a couple of months after leaving Washington Lee, just short of being drafted into the Army, and spent a bit more than 3 years in the Navy, and then came back to Washington Lee in the fall of 54.
So you came back to old Tucker Hall.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
Tell me about old Tucker Hall.
It's right there now, as you know. So.
But it's a very different building
building.
In fact, I saw some pictures yesterday. I've never seen the interior before yesterday, and I'd love it if you would describe what it was like.
Well, it was a lovely building. It had the central core was a large library, reading library. Of course, it would be small by comparison to the present law facility or law library, but it was okay by the standards of that time, and then lovely, comfortable, and welcoming building to be in. It was not an old building, as you know. The old building burned in the 30s. Have you ever seen pictures of that building?
But you can tell me about it.
Well, I don't remember it. It was before my time. That's the only thing you can think of is before my time. I don't remember it, but it was ugly as a mud fence. In fact, it looked somewhat like a mud fence or a lime fence. It was a large limestone building, quite incongruous with the rest of the campus. And burned in the, I've forgotten the date now, late 30s. And and was replaced with Tucker Hall, named after John Randolph Tucker. But it was a marvelous building. It had big, very comfortable classrooms for teaching. And the classrooms in the present law school are modeled after it. They're more modern in appearance, but their configuration and appearance is similar to the ones in old Tucker Hall.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My first office was in a corner of the basement of Tucker Hall. In fact, that's the office I had until I became dean. Now, I may have had 1 year in one of the main floor offices before that time, perhaps. I believe I did. But I was in an office in the basement, and next to me was, shortly after I came back when Clayton Williams was dean, as I mentioned, but Clayton, Dean Williams, retired as dean when he reached the age of, I don't know, 65 or 70, and was succeeded by Charlie Light, who was one of my favorite people, and another person it's a shame you can't talk to now, who was here for many, many years and as a law professor and dean. He was twice dean, in fact. He was dean after Clayton Williams, and then I became dean in 1967, late in 67, and was made president early in 68. So I was, my daughter said I was dean for a day, and I succeeded Light. And then when I became president at the beginning of 1968, the beginning of the second semester of 68, in late January of 68, Charlie Light had to step back in as dean during the time we searched for the dean who became Dean Roy Steinheimer. Charlie used to say he was the only man he knew who succeeded his own successor. he was a wonderful person, one of my closest, really good teacher, great classroom performer.
Tell me about him.
Well, he would pace the platform. The platforms in Tucker Hall, the teaching podium was a long platform, which was raised about a foot above the. Most of the ones in Lewis Hall are that way. And a long desk that you sat behind, the teacher sat behind, I mean, 6 feet long. And Charlie would pace back and forth on that platform. I recall on one occasion he paced so hard he fell off the platform. He'd get so carried away with his comments and his lecture. He taught torts, which is the basic freshman course, and constitutional law was two primary specialties, and was a wonderful teacher. All the law professors were. Clayton Williams was a wonderful teacher. And old Charlie McDowell, I say old to distinguish him from his son, who is about my age, I guess that makes us old, was sort of the third person in that Trinity over there at the law school in those days. And Charles Laughlin came in a little later and was a welcome addition to that group. Wonderful four men. And then they found a young man named Bill Ritz, who turned out to be a wonderful teacher. And others, there were others, but those are the ones who stand out in my thinking. All those men taught me, and all those men then were there when I came back to teach. And all those men were still there when I became dean, which is sort of an unusual relationship. And that was true, of course, with Bill Pusey, for example. Bill Pusey taught me, and I came back and taught here while he was head of the Department of German, and then he became dean under Fred Cole and remained as dean at my request for several years after I became president. So I was never able to call him anything but Dean Pusey until I'd been president for several years, and he finally one day said, "Bob, we've got to stop this. I call you Bob, and you call me Dean Pusey. We've got to get past that." So I finally did. But I was never able to call Clayton Williams anything but Dean Williams or Dr. Laban anything but Dr. Laban. Never able to bring myself to that.
You need to turn the tape over.